Great to see everybody on this holiday weekend. The holiday that's taken a lot of our folks away has also brought us several guests this morning. And so we want you to know how happy we are that you are with us today. In fact, maybe there's somebody in the crowd who is visiting Kleinwood for the very first time. Maybe somebody who comes from a very different religious experience than what you're experiencing here this morning. You know, over the years I've been preaching, one of the things I've come to understand is that when guests visit a place like this for the first time, one of the things that they notice about us is that the stage is empty, right? I mean, we have this massive stage up here, but there's no piano, no setup for the band, not an organ. And I think for a lot of folks who come from different religious experiences, that is a very odd thing. I don't know that we appreciate that. But for guests, that is very different, because largely today, when you go to a church service, somewhere along the way, there is going to be typically a musical performance. I mean, typically singers and a band or beautiful piano music or something like that. And so when people visit us, one of the very first things, even before the service begins, that registers with them is the empty stage. Now, it is interesting, and I think most folks don't recognize this, that it has not always been so. In fact, the truth is, if we could quote a transport back in the past this morning, back to the church at Ephesus in Asia, and if we could gather with them this morning, we would find that there weren't any instruments in their worship either. That in fact, when they worshiped God in song, they just sang like we just did. In fact, generally speaking, I think historians agree with that, that's the way it was in the primitive church. In fact, that's the way it was for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years after the days of the New Testament. I've always found it interesting that the word a cappella, you've heard that, right? Which means to do what we did, sing without instrumental accompaniment. The word a cappella, if you trace its roots, originally meant, ready for this? In the style of the church. Now think about that. Or in chapel style. A cappella comes from a word that means in chapel style, because in the chapel for a long, long time, or in the church, that's how song worship was. It was singing without any instruments. So I just say that to say that it hasn't always been the way it is today. But listen, this is the way it is in the world we live in. Instrumental music was introduced over the centuries and gradually gained wide acceptance. Another thing that a lot of folks don't know is that didn't come easily. Go back a couple of hundred years ago in this country, and there were actually vicious battles waged among the denominations as folks tried to introduce the organ. And that was resisted by many until ultimately we get to where we are today. And instrumental music is kind of the norm. I just want you to have a sense that that's been a rather recent development. But still, because of the way things are today, it's not uncommon to have a guest come, and one of the first things that comes to their mind is, why doesn't your church believe in music? I've been preaching for a while, and I have to say that over the years, I've had lots and lots of visitors come and ask me that question. Where's the band? Why doesn't your church have any music? I don't like the way they word that, but I try not to quibble over that, okay? I think singing is music too. It's just a different kind, right? I've also found myself, and maybe you have too, struggling to figure out how to answer that question for people. Have you ever struggled with that? I mean, you can say, well, there's no musical instruments in there because we don't have any Bible authority to worship that way. But I have found that when you say that to the average folks out in the world, that just kind of falls flat. They don't even really know what they mean. Brothers and sisters, that's code language among us. We get that. I don't know that other people do. And so I don't know that that's a very satisfying answer. And I think we need to be ready to give a better answer. I think we're going to get asked the question a lot, and I believe it's not a triviality. Let's be clear about this, folks. It isn't that there are no instruments up here because that's just sort of Church of Christ weirdness, okay? I think that's the way some people say, well, you know, you guys just kind of got away from that, developed this weird objective to that, no big deal. I need to understand, and we need to help other folks understand, that there's actually big stuff that underlies this one question about our worship, big stuff about worship generally, even about the nature of our relationship with God. And so I think the question deserves a good answer. And so in the evangelism class we did last quarter, if you were in the class, you remember that one of the things we talked about was answering with questions, right? And so I'm going to suggest that. And when somebody asks why the stage is empty, I want to suggest that I think there's some questions we can pose in response that will gently help them see the deeper issues. And so I would like to recommend three this morning. Maybe if you still got a blank page in the back of your Bible that hadn't been ripped out by the kids or marked up with other notes, maybe back there you can jot down these three questions and they'll be useful to you as we all try to talk to other people about what I think is not just a trivial issue, not just Church of Christ weirdness, but something really important about our worship. We need to help folks consider. So when people come to me and they want to know, where are the instruments? Why is there no band? First thing I do is say, do you mind if I ask you a question? And the first question I will pose is this. Can we worship any way that we choose? You think about that? By the way, I really think that gets to the heart of the issue. When we come together and do this, can we just do whatever we want, whatever feels right, whatever is our preference? Or does God give us guidelines? Which way is it? Free for all or guidelines? And I will tell you, I think most folks are going to say, there got to be some guidelines, right? And I think that is so. Will you go back in your Bible to Genesis 4? We're going to go almost all the way back to the beginning in Genesis 4. When we go to the Old Testament, let's start there. In the Old Testament, we find that men never had a right to go out on their own, but God always prescribed how he was to be worshipped. So that's as old as Cain and Abel, right? In Genesis 4, look at verse number 3, Genesis 4, verse 3. So it came about in the course of time that Cain brought an offering to the Lord of the fruit of the ground. Abel also brought the firstlings of his flock and of their portion. So both of the men are engaged in acts of worship. Do you see that? They're bringing sacrifices. But the text says, this is the end of verse 4. The Lord had regard for Abel and his offering, but for Cain and for his offering, he had no regard. Now, we are not going to engage this morning in senseless speculation. I don't know what was wrong with Cain's sacrifice. But you know what I know? I know what was wrong. You see that? I know what was wrong because God wasn't pleased with it. And so what does that necessarily imply? That means that there had to have been some rules about this. And Cain must have known about those rules, and he didn't listen to them. He went out on his own. He did his own thing, and God is not pleased. And so all the way back to Cain and Abel, what did we see? That there were, can we say, rules about worship? I don't know how you're going to get around that when you get to the law of Moses, right? Listen, all the way back to the very beginning of the law, to the Ten Commandments. You ever thought about the fact that the Ten Commandments have worship rules? You don't make any graven images. There were some don'ts even in the Ten Commandments about worship. God says, don't carve a rock and bow down to it and call that worship. I won't have that. God said no to that. He did say, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. And so right up front of the Ten Commandments already, he's laying down rules about worship. And listen, start digging into the book of Exodus and God instructing them to build the tabernacle. Y'all remember that Old Testament tent that they carried around in the wilderness, which was the place where God met with the people and the center of their worship. Have you ever gone through Exodus and read chapter after chapter devoted to how they were to build that? God gave them dimensions and told them what materials they were supposed to use, and he told them where everything was supposed to go in that place and who was going to serve them. He gave rules about how those who served would be consecrated and how the holy items would be consecrated. There is a whole section in there about the oil they would use to consecrate. I mean, over and over again, instructions here about how they were to worship at the tabernacle. And then there's Leviticus. Oh my, Leviticus. Jeff, how many instructions about sacrifices? Jeff likes Leviticus way more than I do, and I know that doesn't surprise you, but I thought about just starting to read and leave the crowd wondering when we would stop this morning, because instruction after instruction about the details of the sacrifices. And then there were the holy days, what the holy days were to be, when they were to be observed, how they were to be observed. In fact, they had an entire feast that was really about camping, right? The Feast of Tabernacles, where they had to go live in the booths for the week observing the feast. That would have been my least favorite holy day, okay? Because it sure looks a lot like camping. What's the point? You make your way through the Old Testament, and God lays out exactly how he wants to be worshipped. I would suggest, brothers and sisters, that he had to do that. The people needed that. Remember, they're coming out of bondage in Egypt, a land that's literally filled with idols. And one of the things we pick up on as we read the Old Testament story is that they had picked up on some of those Egyptian practices. And so when God brings them to Sinai and says, I want you to be my people, he didn't just say, worship me. He also had to say, here is how you are to worship me. Because along the way, they had begun to adopt some Egyptian thinking when it came to worship. I think we see that with the golden calf. Remember when Moses didn't come down from the mountain for a long, long time, and they decided God killed him and he wasn't coming back? And so what did they say to Aaron? They say, make us an idol. And so he does, a calf. Have you ever wondered where he got that idea? Why a calf of all things to make your idol into? Well, my guess is he'd seen some of that down in Egypt. And so he's imitating the worship that they had seen in Egypt. And so understand, it was vital for God to say to them, not only worship me, but here's how you ought to do that. Here's what my worship should look like. And so we see that all the way through the Old Testament. Then we get to the New Testament, and I would contend, folks, we see exactly the same thing. That in the New Testament, God's people are taught how to worship him. And so let me cite some examples of that for you. In John 4 and verse 21, do you remember when Jesus meets the Samaritan woman at the well? He talks to her about worship. That's the topic of their conversation. And he says to her that true worshipers must worship in spirit and in truth. And I understand some folks see that in different ways, but the bottom line is he's saying something about how they worship, right? And then we get into the Corinthian letter. And the Corinthian letter, we find that this church was doing some stuff God wasn't happy about, implying necessarily that you can't just do anything. In chapter 11, he calls them out because they had corrupted the Lord's Supper. They had turned it into something that God doesn't want it to be. And so God inspires Paul to write to them and say, don't do that. When you observe the Lord's Supper, do this. And then in chapter 14, he tells them that everything they did in worship needed to be done in a way that was orderly and edifying. And then scattered throughout the New Testament, we have references to what they did when they worship. And so in Acts 4, for example, in the middle of persecution, the disciples come together and they pray together. And there are references to early Christians singing together and sharing the Lord's Supper. And so what do we do with all that data? New Testament is literally filled with instructions and examples of early disciples worshiping, God showing us what he wants. I would add, That teaching was needed back then as much as Israel needed to be taught at Mount Sinai. Will you pause and think with me about that for a minute? Two main groups made up early congregations, right? You had people who came from a Jewish background and Gentiles who came from a pagan background. Now think about that. If you had Jewish folks in your church, would you say to them, hey, when it comes to worship, just do whatever feels right to you? Because what they would do is stack up some stones and start slaughtering sheep, right? That was their experience. And then you had pagans. And Jeff is mortified about where I may be going with this. No examples, Jeff. How corrupt was pagan worship? You would have never said to someone who had gone to the Temple of Artemis, hey, just do whatever seems right to you when it comes to worship. These early disciples had to be taught not just to worship Jehovah, but they had to be taught how to do it. Does that make sense? And so all the way through Old Testament and New Testament, from beginning to end of the Bible story, we find this same thing. People were never allowed to do whatever they wanted to do. When you worshiped God, He always provided direction. He gave guidance. Can we say He gave us rules to follow? Well, that's the first question. People want to know about instrumental music. My question is, can we worship any way we choose? And the answer to that question is, well, that's never been so. God has always prescribed worship. Well, then there's a second question that has to be answered, if that's true. The second question that has to be answered is this. Did God, I pushed the button, nothing happened. There we go. Did God tell us, did He prescribe that in our worship we would use that form of music? That's a good question. And the answer to that question is yes. And no, right? Because if you go back to the Old Testament, God did prescribe the use of instruments. He said that's what He wanted. So when I say that, I'm thinking about 2 Chronicles 29. Will you go there in your Bible? 2 Chronicles 29. So this is during the reign of Hezekiah, a great Old Testament reformer who's trying to get Israel back to what God wants them to do and worship God the way He wants to be worshiped. And so as all of that's being described, I want to grab just a little portion of this and ask you to notice this with me. This is verse 25 of 2 Chronicles 29. This is what Hezekiah did. The text says, he then stationed the Levites in the house of the Lord with cymbals, with harps, and with lyres, according to the command of David and of Gad the king's seer and of Nathan the prophet, for the command was from the Lord through his prophet. So the Levites stood with musical instruments of David and the priest with the trumpets. Then Hezekiah gave the order to offer the burnt offering on the altar. When the burnt offering began, the song to the Lord also began with the trumpets, accompanied by the instruments of David, king of Israel. While the whole assembly worshiped, the singers also sang and the trumpets sounded. All this continued until the burnt offering was finished. And so I think it's pretty plainly described that in Old Testament worship, sometimes you had singers singing while people were playing along on musical instruments, right? Here's the important thing about that. Will you go up to verse 25? Where did that idea come from? Listen, they weren't just going out on their own here. They didn't do that because they liked the sound of trumpets. Verse 25 says that the command was from the Lord through His prophets. I can tell you why they did all this way. Because God had spoken to His prophet who had gone to the king and said, this is how it's supposed to be done. And so they did it because God instructed them to do it that way. Now, good Bible students know that that doesn't answer our question though, right? Because we understand that the Old Testament was a covenant God made with Israel at Mount Sinai, and it was a covenant that was fulfilled in Jesus Christ. And the book of Hebrews teaches us when Jesus came, he brought a new and better covenant that we live under today. And so when we worship today, we are not looking back at what happened in the Old Testament. We're looking at the New Testament, our covenant with Jesus, to figure out what he wants for us. And I would contend that I think most people get that. If you look back at 2 Chronicles 29, it doesn't just talk about them worshiping by singing and playing along with instruments. It also said they killed animals and burned them up. That was part of it too. Isn't it an interesting thing? All the years I have been preaching, I have never heard of a church that advertised, come on Sunday, we've stacked up some rocks in the auditorium, we're going to slaughter some sheep, bleed them out, and burn them up. We'd like you to come be part of that. And you know why, don't you? Because that would be disgusting, right? I don't want any part of that. But I think most folks understand. We've already had the great sacrifice, Jesus. I was part of an old system and not part of the new system. So what happens when we turn to the New Testament? Is it prescribed there? And that's the curious thing, folks. It's not. There's not an instruction for us to worship in that way. There's no example of that taking place among the New Testament disciples. I'm not even sure there's any place where one could try to infer that. In fact, again, historians, no matter where they are on the issue of using them today, historians agree that primitive disciples did not use any kind of instrument. Why is that? Well, I think it's pretty simple. For the same reason, we're not killing sheep this morning, burning them on an altar. It's part of another system that is not our system. In fact, it's interesting to me that down through history, I told you that the issue of instrumental music has been debated in the past. And it's interesting, when efforts were made to introduce it, one of the pushback arguments that was made is it's Judaizing. It's going back and borrowing from the old covenant, which isn't our covenant. So, did God tell us to use instruments? Not under the covenant of Christ. Now, for some of us, that settles the issue, right? God has told us how to do that. This was not part of his instruction. So when we come together, we do what the New Testament disciples did. We sing. However, I do think there would be some people who would say, but wait, I just really don't think it's that big of a deal. And it is so beautiful. And I enjoy it. Which, by the way, I would give a hearty thumbs up to that. I would love to gather in here on Sunday, have a nice big stretch baby grand piano right over here, get my wife up here playing it, because my wife is a beautiful pianist. And listen, I would enjoy her playing along as we sang. In fact, I'd enjoy it if we'd all just hush and let her play. I like listening to her play. So if this was about me, I'm giving that a thumbs up. In fact, I'll be honest with you. I kind of like the rock band approach too. If I was designing worship for me, guitars and drums, I'm good with that. I'd like that. And so some people would say, if we enjoy it, well, can we just do it anyway? Does it really matter whether one uses instruments or not? Well, the great thing about that question is we don't have to speculate, because ours is not the first generation where men have decided, when it comes to worship, I think we can just go on our own. Where men have decided what we do really doesn't matter. In fact, That's a problem as old as Cain and Abel, isn't it? Because that's exactly what we saw in Genesis 4. I may not be able to tell you how Cain went his own way, but it's pretty clear that that is what he did. And what does the text say about that? Does God applaud Cain? Hey, man, that is really a revolutionary approach to coming to me. I didn't think about that. Good job. The text says that the Lord had no regard for his sacrifice. In Exodus chapter 32, Israel does the same thing. When Moses doesn't come down from the mountain, they build their calf, they have their own worship, and they begin to enthusiastically worship. By the way, I don't think they're worshiping a pagan god there. I know they've built an idol, but I think the text makes clear that the idol for them is a symbol for Jehovah. And so I think the object of the worship in Exodus 32 is right. They're simply employing a modern method, an Egyptian method for worshiping him. How does that work out for them? Does God look down on that and say, well, that was really innovative. Good for you. In verses 9 and 10, I know God is displeased because Moses has to intervene to save the whole nation on that day. There are other examples. We could look at Leviticus chapter 10 when the text says, Nadab and Abihu offered strange fire before the Lord. It's interesting. The language of the text specifically says, which he had not commanded them. This isn't the way I told you to do it. Fire fell from heaven and consumed them. What's the point? We could go back through Bible history and watch as people have tried going on their own, doing worship their own way, and it just never works out well. God is not pleased. And so the question is, if we do the same thing in our time, whatever it is, if we go our own way and do our own thing and please ourselves, the question is, will God be pleased? There is a shift taking place, has been for a while, in how worship is approached. And I think we need to know that's going on and be aware of it and not be caught up in it. The shift is that folks have moved the emphasis from worshiping God to pleasing ourselves. So worship has become a performance, an entertainment hour. Maybe part of it is due to the fact that we have arranged our buildings like entertainment venues, haven't we? You are sitting in the audience, and where am I? I'm up on the stage. Am I performing? When Brian led us in song, was he performing up here for us? Be careful, because sometimes when we talk about church on the way home, it sounds like we are. We're an audience evaluating the performers, right? We need to not get caught up in that, folks, because that's worship exactly backwards. When I lived in Chicago, there was a church that really, really grabbed this and ran with us. Back in the mid-70s, they scattered into their community looking for people who had stopped going to church or didn't go to church, and they asked him why. What was it that you didn't like about church? And so they canvassed their community, got all this data, and used it to build a service that people in their community would want to come to. You know what it looked like? Professional musical performances, short sermons. It's in the article, Jeff. I didn't put it in there. And no Bible thumping. I'm not sure what the Bible thumping was. I have to think about that. And they were hugely successful. In fact, there was a big religious section in our newspaper, and that's how news used to be communicated. They printed it on paper and delivered it to houses. And And in the religion section on Easter Sunday, they had a whole cover story about this group and the 25,000 people they expected at the series of their weekend services, Easter weekend. Wow. Brilliant marketing strategy. But at what price? If fundamentally missed, brothers and sisters, what worship is all about, let's be sure that we don't. Nobody is standing up here performing. All of us are performers, participants. We have come together this morning to offer up a sacrifice of praise to God. He is the only audience of worship. And the men who stand up here, their job is to lead us together in offering something up to Him. We must never forget that. We bring something to the Lord. Listen, you want to have a talk on the way home about how services went today? Here's what the conversations need to be. How was my sacrifice? What did I bring Him today? Because that's what worship is about. You and I coming together, and offering up something to Him. Someone says, aren't we supposed to get something out of this? Absolutely. We're meant to be uplifted, sometimes filled with joy, sometimes filled with sorrow. We're supposed to grow in our knowledge of God. We're supposed to be inspired to live for Him, drawn closer to Him. But here it is. Don't miss this. Here's the key to that. That is only experienced as a byproduct of worshiping God the way He's supposed to be worshiped. Which brings us back to the basic question that's underneath all of this. Who is it that we're trying to please? Who is this for? Am I here for me? Or am I here for Him? And if I'm here for Him and to honor Him, then that should drive me back to His instructions. What has He prescribed? How does God want to be worshiped? And brothers and sisters, if you take that question back to your Bible, how does God want to be worshiped? Nobody ever would be led to put a piano on this stage. It's not part of our covenant. It's not in the book. No one would ever be led to make instrumental music part of his worship. It's an important question. In fact, it's an important question with broader implications. Who are we trying to please? Who is this life all about? Am I in it for me? Am I trying to please the crowd around me? Or am I in it for God? Jesus said in Luke 6:46, "Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not do what I say?" So, there's the question. If the answer is I'm in it for Him, will I do what He said? That's true of worship. It's true of life, period. Am I in this for Him? If I am, will I do what He said? So maybe there's someone this morning, as you're pondering that bigger question, you're thinking to yourself, man, my life doesn't line up with that. I may be saying the right stuff, but when it comes to the doing, I'm not living the way He wants me to live. This family would like nothing more on this weekend to rally around you and support you as you strive to make your way back to God and renew your commitment to Him. If you've never made that choice, you need to be a disciple. Confess that you believe Jesus is Lord. Let Him wash you clean in baptism. We'd like nothing more than to be able to help you with that. Everything's ready for you to do that. We can do it right now. So if you need to respond, make your way to the front right now while we stand, while we sing this song together.